This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Who's responsible for the opioid epidemic in America? Dozens of U.S. states and cities, including here in Connecticut, are suing the maker of painkiller OxyContin produced by Stanford-based Purdue Pharma. They accuse the pharmaceutical company of fraud and deceptive marketing to sell the painkiller while downplaying addiction risk. Coming up, we're going to hear from one of the cities in Connecticut, the city of Danbury, about its decision to sue. A new book by journalist Beth Macy investigates the opioid crisis from the time OxyContin came onto the market to how prescription drugs led to the epidemic. She charts its course through central Appalachia before it spread to suburbs and cities nationwide. The book is called Dopesick: Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. Beth Macy is the author and journalist, and she's written several books. Beth, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Now, Beth is joining us today from the studios of WVTF in Roanoke, Virginia, and our listeners can join our conversation, too. That number, 860-275-7266. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I understand you're a reporter for the Roanoke Times in Virginia for many years. So what motivated you to write this book?
So I started writing about heroin. I was the family's beat reporter until 2014, and I wrote a three-part series about heroin when it landed in the wealthy white suburbs around 2010, and readers sort of went, you know, choked on their coffee and said, holy crap, white kids are doing heroin? And nobody knew because nobody had paid attention when the opioid crisis was first breaking out in the rural hinterlands. And then, of course, in the suburbs where kids had the money to hide their addiction, it took a long while before it became aware in the suburbs and cities, too. So that really allowed it to fester and grow.
And so you broke up your book in three different ways by looking at three different communities. Walk us through those communities.
Sure. I saw these three different communities as sort of standing in for a microcosm of America. I start out with central Appalachia. The westernmost county in Virginia is called Lee County. And that's where they really first started having problems with OxyContin abuse and overprescribing it, almost immediately after the drug was introduced in 1996. And then I follow the spread to heroin in the mid-aughts and late-aughts, and then through Roanoke, Virginia, where I've been a reporter for almost 30 years. And then more recently, because there's nowhere the opioid crisis isn't, I followed sort of the spread to heroin and fentanyl in a non-distressed kind of idyllic farm community called Woodstock, Virginia, where a twice-convicted drug dealer had landed and started bringing heroin in from Harlem.
And we're going to hear more about this conversation you had with this dealer, Ronnie Jones, actually in prison. But when we look at the title of your book, Beth, you chose to call it Dopesick. When we hear that term, tell us what you mean and then why you chose it for this book.
I chose it because it's kind of in your face, and it's also the concept that most Americans still don't seem to quite grasp. Early on in the book, a woman in the coal fields is talking about when she was overprescribed OxyContin and realized she was addicted, and then talked a neighbor into getting her doctor to write her prescriptions that she could then sell to her, because the main fear is always not to be in withdrawal, which they call dopesick. And she said, at the end of your journey, you're not doing heroin or pills to get high. You're doing it so as not to be dopesick. And they all describe it, almost to a person, as the worst flu times 100. It is diarrhea, sweats, vomiting, nausea, restless leg. And person after person that I interviewed who is addicted to these morphine-based products, they are pretty much describe it almost as if their brains are hijacked by the molecule.
That's interesting that you chose that title. And because you've been a reporter and you mentioned the series you did back in 2010, you're very well of the stigma that surrounds addiction in this country, and this idea that, well, why can't people just stop taking it? And this idea that because the brain has been rewired because of the strength of these opioids, it's not that simple just to stop.
Not that simple. And the stigma is huge. And that, as I said earlier, that is part of why this epidemic was allowed to fester and grow. When we started seeing it in our cities and suburbs, and the kids sort of had the money initially to hide their addiction, you know, they would say their iPad was stolen when really they pawned it for drugs and their parents would get them another, et cetera, et cetera. The few parents that were in on the, quote, dirty little secret, you know, had the money to send their kids off to rehab. But of course, that didn't necessarily make the problem go away either. One of the more stunning statistics, I'm not a big numbers person, but the number that sort of grabbed me was John Kelly out of Harvard saying it takes the typical person who's addicted to opioids 8 years and 5 to 6 recovery attempts to achieve 1 year of remission. So this isn't something we can just turn off.
Beth Macy is the author of the book Dope Sick, which we're talking about for the hour here on Where We Live. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. And we know many of you have been touched by opioid abuse in your family, maybe in your life. And we want to hear a little bit about your reaction to how our communities around this country, including the government, is responding to this crisis. And you can also tweet us at Where We Live. Beth, tell us about the role of prescription painkillers, specifically when we talk about OxyContin, which we know here in Connecticut, produced by a company, Purdue Pharma, based in Stamford.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when it was introduced in 1996, they hired an army of sales reps to go out across the country. The reps, they bought them data showing which doctors in the country prescribed the most competing opioids. So at the time, those would have been immediate-released opioids like Vicodin, Percocet, Lortab. And the reps were sent out to the doctors who were already prescribing a lot of those drugs, and they were given this pitch that OxyContin was better because it lasted 12 hours, which it didn't quite, and also that it was, quote, addiction was, quote, exquisitely rare, or addiction only happened in less than 1% of all cases. And they trotted out bad data. The FDA allowed them to make this very squishy claim that because of the time-release mechanism, it was believed to reduce the liability of abuse. And what happened in these rural distressed communities where the jobs were closing, the factories were going overseas, is these tended to be areas where there were instances of actual pain and workplace injuries. So that's why you see the epidemic sort of the alarm bell sounding there first, the late 90s, the early aughts. I mean, in Lee County, which I write in depth about, you have a rural country doctor who's being called out in the middle of the night for overdose cases of kids he had immunized as babies, and people overdosing in the Lee High School library, and farmers and miners committing horrible crimes never more seen in that community because they were already addicted to that drug. And I guess the important distinction to make is before, when they had been injured, they had taken these immediate-release opioids and had been able to take them correctly and get off them when the prescription was finished. But with OxyContin, it was just so much stronger. As one police officer told me, the difference was it turned them into, quote, non-functioning people.
Mm. When we think about opioid painkillers like OxyContin, traditionally, how were they prescribed? And then with the marketing that Purdue Pharma put in place, with the incentivizing of their drug reps, how did that change this? How did that change the doctor's perspective of when exactly to prescribe this pill?
Right. For 100 years, opioids were known to be addictive. And so they were only used in cases of very severe pain, end of life, cancer pain, right? And so the pharmaceutical industry, led by Purdue, but also others, sort of trumpeted this notion that pain was being undertreated. A lot of that grew out of the hospice movement in the 80s. But you saw pain as a fifth vital sign in the early 90s, managed care, all these things sort of conspired with the introduction of OxyContin to create the perfect storm. And the sales reps were incentivized because the more milligrams they talked a doctor into prescribing of OxyContin, the bigger the bonuses were.
It's pretty infuriating reading the book when you go through some of these bonuses, even the way drug reps, there was one example where there was a birthday party involved. Can you talk about that, Beth?
Yeah, that wasn't Purdue. I mean, these were all pharmaceutical companies, not just the opioid makers. But yeah, one chain smoking doctor in Wytheville, Virginia, put up a sign in her lobby for the reps to sponsor her kid's 13th birthday party to Carowinds, the amusement park. And the rep who told me that story said he had gotten to her office and they all knew she was a chain smoker. And so he sat down, he was waiting for her to come back, and there was a carton of cigarettes with a Celexa sticker on it. So they would find out what the doctors liked, whether it was Cuban cigars, whether it was, you know, a particular restaurant, and they would show up with food from that restaurant or the cigars and court the doctors. Of course, that doesn't happen anymore to the degree. I'm told the free meals are still a regular thing at doctors' offices, but it now all part of healthcare reform, that all has to be reported. Mm-hmm. So we have seen a positive change in that.
There was a doctor that you interviewed that thought this was wrong early on and tried to get the other doctors in his practice to sign on that they're not going to accept these incentives and these freebies, but that wasn't something that was taken very well.
Yeah, he was kind of the loner. He said he used to go into the fridge and bring his cold leftovers from home and kind of slink back to his office. The other doctors in his practice said, but what will the staff and the nurses and the receptionists think if we take the free meals away? And it just became this groupthink. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I was a newspaper reporter, we weren't allowed to take anything. If somebody sent us flowers after we did a story that perhaps they liked about us, we had to give the flowers away to a homeless shelter mm-hmm. or domestic violence shelter. I mean, there are ethics rules in place for journalists that doctors who make so much more money than journalists were apparently, not required to hew to. Mm-hmm.
So because of all this effort to sell the drug, so to speak, to doctors who then in turn prescribed it to patients starting in these very poor areas like Lee County, what kind of impact did that have in the community? And who were the first people? You mentioned this one doctor, but others that started to sound the warning that this was going to end badly.
Oh, yeah. So Art Van Zee from St. Charles works at a federally qualified sliding scale health center. He started calling them, writing letters right away. One of his earliest letters said something to the effect of, you know, writing the medical director of Purdue, "My fear is that these distressed rural areas are sentinel areas, just the way San Francisco and New York were in the early years of HIV. And of course, he was absolutely right. I found the police officer out there who, you know, as early as 97 or 98, he wasn't sure, but one of his longtime confidential informants leans into his car and says, "This feller up here has got this new drug he's selling. It's called OxyContin. And he says it's great." So that police officer, now retired, told me you could walk around these little coalfield communities back in those early days and you could see people with green and orange smudges on their shirts. So what they did was they almost immediately figured out how to beat the time lapse mechanism of OxyContin, the 12-hour time lapse mechanism. They would put it in their mouth, wait for the coating to melt off, and then they would rub the coating or the time lapse mechanism off on the shirts. So the pills were orange and green, the 40 and 80 milligrams. And, you know, so he was seeing that as early as the late 90s. Pharmacists were being broken into. One pharmacist started telling his customers right away, "You lock this up because people will break into your house for this." Grocery store manager from the coal fields was shot and killed because he was making a night deposit with the grocery store earnings of the day, and somebody was so dope sick they needed to get his money to buy more street OxyContin. Mm.
Meanwhile, Beth, we mentioned this drug came onto the market, I think, in 1996. How was Purdue Pharma benefiting when we look at the profits within over a 10-year period?
Well, according to a New Yorker piece that ran in January of this year, they made more than $30 billion. The big thing they did was they changed the narrative around opioids, which for a century we knew were not safe except for at end of life and very severe pain. They made it okay for doctors to be comfortable to prescribe them for moderate pain, so low back pain, osteoarthritis, things that before we would have just used Tylenol or aspirin for, or non-opioid medications. They preach that narrative really hard with the sales reps. And of course, now you see the CDC guidelines in 2016 going back to, we only give opioids in severe pain. And we're going back to that thinking that we had for a century. But what they really did was flip the narrative.
We've been talking about Purdue Pharma, the company, but it was the Sacklers who founded that company, again, based in Stamford, Connecticut. What can you tell us about them, Beth?
Well, it was a small company. Began in the 50s and was before the painkillers, was best known for betadine, earwax remover, laxatives. And it was headed up by three brothers who were research psychiatrists, and Arthur Sackler in particular, no longer living, was not part of the OxyContin development team, but he was really sort of the pioneer of medical marketing and had a newspaper, sort of pioneered this idea of paying doctors to become paid spokesmen for drugs. And, you know, he was known for the ad campaign for Valium, becoming Mother's Little Helper, and that kind of thing. And so when you see his relatives sort of using some of these same techniques with OxyContin, these are ideas that were pioneered by Arthur Sackler originally.
In your book, you write Purdue had earned over $2.8 billion from OxyContin by 2007, including $595 million in earnings in 2006 alone. With me today from the studios of WVTF in Roanoke is Beth Macy. She's a journalist and author of the most recent book, Dopesick: Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. We're going to continue our conversation with her after the break, and we want to hear from you. How should opioid addiction be treated in communities? What has been your experience or your family's experience? This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Join us at 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. How much has the opioid crisis cost communities nationwide, from lost productivity, hospitalizations, and incarceration, among other consequences? 100 Americans are dying from overdoses every day. As our guest today, Beth Macy, writes in her book, Dopesick, epidemiologists predict the toll could spike to 250 a day as synthetic opioids like fentanyl become more pervasive. What's the answer to solving this crisis? What has been your family's experience with opioid abuse? You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. Beth Macy's joining us from Roanoke, Virginia today. Your book chronicles the stories of many people who are fighting back, but one of the people that you start the book with is someone who was put into prison for dealing, and that's Ronnie Jones. Tell us about him, Beth, and why you chose to go to prison to interview him.
Sure. Well, when I was circling back to first start doing my research for my book proposal, I went back to the prosecutors that I had interviewed for that initial story that I wrote in 2012 and asked if they could just talk about what they were seeing now. And of course, they were seeing the same thing, but more of it, and in places where they had never seen it happening before, like this rural farm town, not a distressed area, in the northern Shenandoah Valley. And one of the prosecutors said, we just put 84 people away on federal and state charges. And the ringleader at the top was this fellow named Ronnie Jones. He had been sent to this small town to work in a chicken plant to serve out the last part of his prison sentence for an earlier charge. He had previously been a crack and marijuana dealer. And so when he got out and he decided to stay in the region, no one would hire him. He starts going back to selling marijuana, and somebody says, well, remember in the break room of the chicken plant, everybody was doing opioid pills. If you really want to make money, because the pills are getting more expensive and harder to get, you need to bring heroin. So as the prosecutors and the police told the story, almost overnight, this kind of idyllic little farm town goes from goes from having a handful of known heroin users to almost hundreds as the people make the switch from pills to heroin. And I'm at the beginning, I'm going to interview him in prison at the request of a young man, 19 years old. He was a high school football star who had initially been addicted to painkillers from a snowboarding accident. And he ends up dead on somebody else's bathroom floor. And his mother just can't understand. I meet her at his gravesite overlooking the football field where Jesse had once made the crowd roar. And his mother says to me, "I thought it was just pills. Can you help me understand why it is I lost my beautiful, burly 19-year-old son who never missed a day of work? I thought it was just pills."
That's interesting, that disconnect that we're hearing the mother when she says she thought it was just pills. People still weren't really aware of the consequences of prescription drug abuse and how that can lead to heroin abuse as well.
Yeah. And one of the things I noticed, I first heard it from Jesse's mom, Christy, but then I started noticing in all the stories I was collecting, not all, but a significant portion, probably three quarters, the kids had initially, the kids who were overdosing, like in their at 19 and 20, had started off taking ADHD medication. And the science on this isn't clear. Another message of the book, the science is never quite all the way clear. It's called practicing medicine, right? But you see kids that start out with Ritalin and Adderall at a young age, and we know there's a lot of overdiagnosing of that condition. When they become high schoolers, start trading the pills for harder things. And in Jesse's case, he did initially get hooked to an oxycodone-based product and then started trading his ADHD medication in order not to be dope sick. And, you know, we've just seen a huge increase in our country with this idea that there's a pill for every ill. I mean, to the point that two-thirds of our college seniors now have been offered prescription stimulants for non-medical use. I just think that's crazy.
This is where we live. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Dan is calling from Hartford. Dan, go ahead with your question or comment.
Hey, yeah. First, I want to thank you guys for actually talking about this topic because it kind of touches home a lot. I've been a cancer patient and for 2010, and I was prescribed painkillers like you would not believe. They started off with 245 milligram oxys, and then eventually after 2 years of on that, I was able to up myself to 15s, then up to 30s, so I was getting 180 30s a day or a month and 245s a month, along with 25 milligram fentanyl patches, 25 of those a month. And I've been clean over a year. It was just that the doctors don't care who's really on it. They just prescribe whatever they want and however much they want. And I was able to get whatever I wanted. And all I had to do is say my back's bothering me, my legs bother me, because that's where my cancer was located. And now that I'm off of it, I could see people that I know that are on it. And what's been going on is they prescribe so much that people are not getting that high anymore. And I see it with friends that I don't talk to anymore, but it's led to heroin use, and I've known enough people who've died off of it, and it's sad what is going on in society, where people are able to get just so much medication and narcotics that they don't even need them. And I think personally, doctors should be counting on a regular basis the prescriptions that they're giving out to people, and doing pill counts on a regular basis to control how much people are taking, and even doing drug tests, because some of those people that are getting the prescriptions are just selling them and buying heroin, unfortunately, some people that you've talked about.
Well, Dan, thank you. I want to have Beth Macy just respond to what you were talking about, but thank you for your call. I'm interested in hearing your take, Beth, because in your book you talk about some of the ways communities, states have responded. I know even here in Connecticut there's now prescription drug monitoring program, but from what Dan is saying, you know, is it effective?
Well, I think doctors are being a lot more cautious about that. In fact, I'm hearing from a lot of people who used to be in Dan's situation who are, you know, people who are having the opposite problem. Actually, they can't get their painkillers. One of my colleagues at the newspaper, in fact, she's on some painkillers as a way to avoid a surgery. And, you know, she gardens and she beekeeps and she's a very active person. And she says, without these drugs, I couldn't do my job. I'd have to have this life-threatening surgery. And so we just need more nuance, but definitely, you know, we do need a big correction. And I think you're starting to see that with the CDC guidelines in 16 that says only use the opioids if everything else has been tried first and only use them in the most severe cases. But I also think if we just leave these patients in severe pain, cancer patients, et cetera, just out to dry, they are going to go because of that fear of dope sickness. They're going to go, and you're seeing some of the data from public health journals saying they do go to heroin and they are at risk of overdose death. So we just need a really thoughtful, nuanced approach to this. Mm.
Over the years, many lawsuits have been brought against Purdue Pharma. Tell us about what happened in 2007 and what was the result when I believe it's a U.S. attorney in Virginia that went after Purdue.
Yeah, based in Roanoke, here where I live, John Brownlee was a U.S. attorney at the time, started investigating the company and over a five-year period. And ended up filing criminal misbranding charges. There was a plea agreement in Abingdon, Virginia, which is not far from where Dr. Van Zee practiced in the coal fields. And Purdue, the company, actually the holding company, Purdue Frederick, pleaded guilty to criminal misbranding, felony charge, and the three top executives pleaded guilty to misdemeanor versions. No one went to jail, though, and because it was the holding company, not Purdue Pharma, Purdue Pharma was able still to do business with TRICARE, Medicaid, Medicare. Nothing really happened. Sales continue to increase. And none of that money, okay, so they paid a $634.5 million fine. None of that money went to treatment. So you hear now a lot about this multi-jurisdictional litigation being overseen by a federal judge in Cleveland. And many activists and advocates are really hoping that the money for treatment will be, will be there in the settlement that comes out of that. And that's against Purdue, not just Purdue, but many opioid makers and distributors.
We're going to get into treatment options in just a little bit. I'm talking with Beth Macy, the author of Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. You mentioned the multi-jurisdictional lawsuits that are coming down the line. The city of Danbury is one of several Connecticut municipalities suing. Mayor Mark Boughton joins us now by phone. Mayor Boughton, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Lucy.
So tell us about Danbury's decision to sue, and who are you suing, and what would you want the outcome to be? Where would the money go?
Yeah, we're suing the makers of the particular drugs in question, the opioids in question, and really we're looking for assistance, financial assistance, with both the outcome of somebody who's addicted in terms of the cost to the community, as well as some proactive approaches in terms of treatment and supporting some of our groups out there. I've been listening to the show. I think everything has pretty much been covered in terms of what the problem is. But also, as somebody who was a patient with brain surgery, who had a tumor out of his head, there also is it's a very nuanced issue, because it became very difficult to get any kind of pain reliever except for Tylenol. And I had a rough couple of months there. So I think there's a balance that has to be struck in there, and I think we need Purdue and every other manufacturer's assistance in finding that balance. Look, we need to go after the doctor that's prescribing a million pills a month. We know there's something wrong there, and the folks that are out there that are selling this stuff. But more importantly, too, we need to understand that there is value to this medication if used appropriately and correctly and not abused. And mm-hmm. So somehow we've got to make them a partner in this, and the only way we can bring them to the table is through a lawsuit.
Mayor Boughton, thank you for that point, bringing that up about what happened after your brain surgery and this the struggle sometimes to get relief with a medication. Beth Macy, you mentioned that, I believe, in your book, that you've heard from people, too, that say, look, sometimes now I'm being treated like I'm an addict, but I do need this medicine for a legit condition.
Right. Right, right. And I think doctors are getting, rightfully more cautious, but we don't want to overcorrect either because we don't want those people going into the black market and buying heroin to stave off their dope sickness and then getting fentanyl in it and overdosing and dying. And I mean, the important thing to remember is even though doctors are being better about not overprescribing, we still have 2.6 million people with opioid use disorder in this country. Some experts believe it's as many as 4 million. And so the horse is out of the barn. That's, to me, really where I'm hoping Judge Polster can make these companies come up with settlement monies that will go toward treatment in providing low threshold access to medication-assisted treatment, which study after study shows is the best way to prevent overdose death.
We're going to get to that in just a couple of minutes, but I did want to ask Mayor Boughton while he's on the line. Again, you're participating in a suit to try to get these opioid drug makers to pay for the consequences of these prescription drugs that have led to the opioid epidemic around the country. What has been the impact in your city?
Well, first of all, I mean, as already mentioned, the deaths have been absolutely tragic, and it absolutely always is that leap from the pills to heroin because heroin's more available. It gives you a similar high, and the pills on the street value, in addition, one oxycodone pill could be anywhere between $30 and $40 per pill, whereas you can get five times that high off of heroin. So people are out there in that marketplace trying to satiate their addiction. So because of that, we've seen between 30 and 50 deaths per year of people from overdoses, and it's absolutely tragic. And oftentimes, as mentioned, the material is laced with fentanyl, which is highly dangerous for people. So we know that's a problem, and there's a cost to that. We also know that we're picking up people on the street who are ODing, and we just recently saw a horrible case in different substance, but still a horrible case in New Haven, where people are ODing, and there's a cost to the hospitals, there's a cost to the ambulances, there's a cost to our emergency management and public safety personnel. It costs the city to manage this addiction problem, and so we have tallied that cost on a yearly basis, and that is well north of several million dollars to our city. And we expect to be compensated for that. And then obviously we would want to use those monies for proactive treatment and programming and education for people that are out there in terms of understanding this can be a real danger to you.
Mayor Mark Boughton from the City of Danbury, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is Where We Live. Today we're looking into the opioid epidemic in our country through the lens of this new book, Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. Beth Macy's a journalist and author of this book, among others. She's joining us from Roanoke, Virginia today. We've mentioned medication-assisted treatment a couple of times, so let's get to that, because some of the people that you profile in your book, there are parents who have the means to pay for rehab in and out again for their children who have become addicted. But let's talk about what are the treatment options out there and what does science show what actually can help someone who's been addicted to opioids?
Sure. You mentioned the parents paying thousands of dollars to send their kids to out-of-state rehabs. Most of the rehabs in this country don't allow medication-assisted treatment because they're abstinence only. So less than half, and only 2% allow all three kinds of medication-assisted treatment, which are methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone, or Vivitrol is the brand name. And what I saw over and over as I was following some of these families for the last 2.5 years is just sort of Herculean efforts to get the money to send their addicted 20-something-year-old to a recovery center across the country. They would bomb out of that. They would check themselves out, and they were living on the streets and mixing with criminal gangs and prostitution, many of them prostituting, to get those drugs. And after all of my research, I have come to believe that it is just so much safer to keep people in their home communities, but to make access to this MAT, or medication-assisted treatment, buprenorphine and methadone are the best ways, according to every scientific survey, to make them accessible to people, many of whom are living on the streets, in a really low threshold way. So to me, that comes down to what my one of my main sources, young Tess Henry, told me the first time I interviewed her. She had been addicted by two 30-day prescriptions to opioids for a simple case of bronchitis at an urgent care center. And the first time I interviewed her in late 2015, she said, "What we need are urgent care centers for the addicted." And to me, that's a syringe exchange and recovery program, because we have skyrocketing hepatitis C rates, potential skyrocketing HIV rates because of people sharing dirty needles. We have law enforcement officers getting stuck by them and having to be tested for a year to make sure they don't get hepatitis C. It's a danger to have these dirty needles out there. And what a syringe exchange can do is not only provide clean needles until somebody's ready to go to treatment, but it's also a really low threshold, easy access way to then refer people to treatment in their communities.
We hosted a panel discussion in New Haven at Gateway Community College a couple of months ago, Beth, where we had an epidemiologist and a former opioid abuser on this panel. Former abuser now works in recovery. And there was quite a tension between both of them about approaches to treatment, meds versus beds. Where does that tension come from? Because the former opioid abuser says that abstinence was his way, and they don't want to be encouraging people to be on medication the rest of their lives, to trade one drug for another.
Yes, I heard that over and over, and I saw that play out with Tess, for instance, who I was just speaking about. But it comes from, you know, an AA and NA believe in abstinence only, and many of these treatment centers were designed around that 12-step philosophy. And I'm so glad for people for whom abstinence only treatment works. I'm so happy for them. But the numbers are really clear, 10 to 11%. Can get better from opioid addiction using abstinence-only 12-step versus medication-assisted treatment plus therapy and counseling and social supports. Numbers can be as high as 50 to 60% in preventing overdose death. So I think it's pretty clear, and I have seen so many people struggle, so many people be stigmatized, sitting in NA meetings with young Tess Henry multiple times, and they would allow her to be there, but when she would ask for somebody to sponsor her, they would say, "No, if you're on Suboxone, no way, sorry. You know, you're not, quote, clean." And that was like daggers to her, and that, you know, just sort of led her back to the streets. And so it can go both ways. The important thing to remember is not every addiction treatment works for every person who's addicted, so it's important to offer them all, really important.
Speaking of buprenorphine, if I'm saying that right, sold under the brand name Suboxone, there was news recently, Beth Mace, we wanted to bring it up during the show, that Purdue Pharma, the same company that created OxyContin, and throughout your book you talk about their role, and it's still being debated on how much they play in this opioid epidemic, but they now have received a new drug, and I'm going to quote from the Financial Times: "The invention is a novel form of buprenorphine, a mild opiate that controls drug cravings, which is often given as a substitute to people hooked on heroin or opioid painkillers such as OxyContin." So this is a drug intended to wean those who are addicted to opioids. But this is a company, again, that is now going to be able to make money off of a version of buprenorphine?
That's right. So Richard Sackler, who was the CEO of Purdue, was one of the inventors of a patent for this new form of opioid use disorder treatment. And the critics say he's now going to be able to benefit even more from a crisis that his family's company is accused of fueling. Somebody on Twitter the other day said that was like a glass repair company taping their business card to a brick and chucking it through your window. Making money again, but this new formulation of buprenorphine is supposed to be a wafer that dissolves faster. Law enforcement will likely maybe be perhaps more favorable to it because there could be less of a risk of diversion and abuse. So again, nuanced discernment of this drug is needed. And the fact that just the fact itself that we're trying to get a better form of buprenorphine is not bad per se. Mm-hmm. It's good, but I would also like to see it in conjunction with this company, which profited so much off of this epidemic, to pay back some of those profits they've gained.
Beth Macy is a journalist joining us from Roanoke, Virginia today from the studios of WVTF. Her new book is Dope Sick: Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. We're going to continue our discussion right after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil, and we want to hear from you too. Join us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today, my guest is Beth Macy, author of the new book, Dope Sick. And before we talk a little bit more about some of the stories that she uncovered in her new book, I want to take a call. Hassan is calling from Norwich. Hassan, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mohammad Hassan Majid. I'm a child psychiatrist and addiction psychiatrist with deep interest in opioid addiction and pain management. First, thank you for taking my call. And I really appreciate a very important topic. So I will make two comments here. One, I was listening earlier, and Beth Macy mentioned about the over-treatment of ADHD, and it is linked, somehow I heard this way, that it is linked with opioid addiction. I think it differently. While I completely agree that, you know, some children, even in my practice, I get to know sometimes they're trading off their stimulant medications for other things. Could it be opioids, marijuana, and other drugs? But I think that science is pretty much clear. Untreated ADHD leads to more risk-taking behavior, and one of them is experimenting with other drugs. And unfortunately, in current time, this is opioid. So that was one comment. And the second thing is, as my interest is in pain management, and I write extensively about it, that something is missing from pain management, which is, one, psychiatrists are not taking interest in pain management. And I will divide it into two things. Other than opioids, all other other than NSAIDs and acetaminophen, which are common over-the-counter medications most of the time. But other medications are antidepressants, mood stabilizer, anticonvulsants, which we psychiatrists use every day to treat different disorders, depression, anxiety. And these disorders are extremely comorbid with pain as well, like depression, anxiety, personality disorder, substance use disorder, unfortunately. So I believe if psychiatrists get involved more in treatment of chronic pain disorder, we can provide better care in many ways.
Hassan, thank you for those two comments. I wanted to get Beth Macy to respond first to the families where you they told you that with ADHD, their children having the Ritalin, the Adderall, that might have impacted their child's addiction later on, and then this new focus on pain management.
Yeah, and I say in the book that the science is unclear. I hear his point about untreated ADHD leading to risk-taking behavior, but there's also a lot of data that it is overdiagnosed, and you know, a lot of parents want their children to have the best shot at doing well in their school studies, and you hear that over and over again. In terms of the pain, and I do say in the book, I quote studies that conflict that are both pretty current. So I believe the science is still a bit unclear on that, and more research needs to be done. In terms of the pain management and this idea of psychiatrists dealing, child psychiatrists in particular, dealing with pain management medication, in particular buprenorphine, I think it's really clear that we need more doctors to become waivered to prescribe buprenorphine, not for just children, but for everyone. In France, where they took the waiver requirement away, they expanded the capacity for prescribing buprenorphine times 10, and their overdose deaths went down 87%. So many doctors still don't want to do this. It's perhaps a bit cumbersome. The DEA has to sign off. I know part of it is still the stigma. They don't want, quote, addicts in their waiting room. But look, they have, quote, addicts in their waiting room. And doctors helped us get into this epidemic. I think they should feel morally compelled to help get us out.
We got a tweet from a listener, Christina, who writes, since graduating from Southington High School in 2009, I've lost 4 classmates to opioid addiction. Mm-hmm. Each person started using their prescription medication. We just have a couple of minutes left, Beth Macy. But when you read your book, Dope Sick, you know, with this epidemic, we naturally want to find someone to blame for where we are today. And you walk us through meeting dealer Ronnie Jones, talking about the pharmaceutical company that produced this very strong and addictive painkiller. But when you're talking with the families affected, you know, who do they blame?
It's kind of all over the map. Some blame the person who sold their child the drugs that they overdosed on, not really understanding that that person was addicted to, and more than likely just selling those drugs to, supply his own heroin. Many people blame the pharmaceutical companies for, you know, the criminal misbranding that went on. Many people blame the doctors who took a lot of, 5,000 of whom, doctors, nurses, and pharmacists became paid spokesmen for the drug. There's a lot of blame to go around, but what we really need now with at least 2.6 million people addicted to opioids, we need leadership to get us out of it.
Speaking of leadership, we look often to Washington to help with funding, to support treatment options. Mixed messages coming from the Trump administration on this one, Beth?
Yeah. A few months ago, he was talking about executing drug dealers. And I think back to people like Tess and to Jesse that I write about and Brian. I mean, these are tree trimmers and high school football stars and cheerleaders that are largely dealing to support their own habits. And I think more nuance is needed. I mean, he said he was going to declare a national emergency, and he's declared a public health emergency, which sounds like a national emergency, but it gives no new authority or money for treatment. And that's what we really need. Experts believe we need $60 billion over the next 10 years to appropriately get opioid use disorder treatment enmeshed with our healthcare system. That's a lot of money, and we're seeing dribs and drabs being debated in Congress. We need real leadership at both federal, state, and local levels.
Beth Macy, again, is a journalist and author of the book Dope Sick. Before we let you go, I understand that you wear a locket with the picture of one of the individuals you profiled in your book. Tell us a little bit about Tess and why you wear her picture.
Yeah, it's a locket, and it's got a poem by E.E. Cummings engraved on the outside of it. Her mother gave it to me. She has a matching one. And the poem was called I Carry Your Heart in My Heart, and it represents the way Tess felt about her son. She had lost custody of him when he was just a toddler. I didn't see him for many months up until she was murdered on Christmas Eve in Las Vegas after checking herself out of an abstinence-only rehab. She so wanted to get better so she could parent her child again. And inside the locket, I keep a picture of her with her rescue dog, Coda, who she loved. And I keep a picture on the other side of the locket of James Baldwin, who said, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced. And I hope the message of this book is that until we understand how we got here and where the gaps are in treatment, we're still going to be a country where it's so much easier to get addicted than it is to get help for addiction.
The book is called Dope Sick: Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. Beth Macy, it was a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much.
You too, Lucy. Thank you.
Today's show produced by senior producer Lydia Brown. Special thanks to Carmen Baskoff. Our technical producer is Kyone Wolf. Learn more about the show, wmpr.org/where we live. You can always download our podcast. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.